Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Volatility and Perspective Kayne Anderson Rudnick conference call. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Barry Mandanach. Sir?
Okay, thank you, Ian, and thanks everybody for joining us. This is Barry Mandanach, and I'm head of distribution for Virtus Investment Partners. In response to the extreme volatility that we've seen over the past few weeks and the large volume of questions that we've been getting from you, effectively our clients, we decided to host a three-day series of market update calls featuring a number of our investment professionals from the Virtus-affiliated managers. Today is about Kayne Anderson Rudnick. Tomorrow we'll feature Sykes Investment Advisors, and on Thursday, Von Tobel Asset Management. Today's call will feature Doug Forman, John Christensen, and Craig Thrasher, and our discussion is going to center around the impact of coronavirus has had on the U.S. and the international equity markets. Doug Forman serves as Chief Investment Officer, and he's a portfolio manager and is a member of Kayne Anderson's Executive Management Committee. John is a portfolio manager and senior research with primary research responsibilities for the small and mid-cap healthcare sector. And Craig is a portfolio manager and senior research analyst with primary research responsibilities for the international and emerging market small-cap equities portfolios. So I welcome Doug Forman, John Christensen, and Craig Thrasher to the call. What I'd like to do is turn it over to Doug Forman for some higher-level thoughts about the markets and where we are, and then we'll go around the horn, and then we'll get to some questions. So, Doug, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you all for joining us today. Hopefully we'll be able to provide you with some food for thought, at least about what's going on. Equities had a terrible first quarter, as you all know, as global business activity essentially ground to a complete halt. Most of the U.S. is adhering to this stay-at-home rules. You know, restaurants, bars, retailers, traffic here in the L.A. area is non-existent. They're all shuttered. And, you know, you don't need to be an economist to figure out that this is going to trigger a recession. So, you know, businesses in particular that depend on leisure and business travel have been hit the hardest during this decline. Hotels, casinos, cruise lines, airlines, et cetera, just to name a few. But the bottom line is if you have high fixed labor and capital costs in this environment combined with a leveraged balance sheet, you're in a really dangerous position since you've got no incoming revenue. So the clock's ticking on you if you meet that type of criteria. So investors are justifiably worried that these businesses can't survive for the long term. The longer this virus threat goes on, the higher likelihood they are to put up the bankruptcy signs on these types of businesses in particular. Every decline is different and every recession is different. This one's no exception. It's triggered by health concerns, obviously. And the speed at which this has happened has been unprecedented, in my opinion, in at least 33 years that I've been doing this. And the other thing that's interesting is, you know, demand usually falls off gradually in a recession, and it happens over a 12 to 18-month period as investors and policymakers finally figure out we're going into a recession. But this was almost a complete shutdown overnight in our economy. So it happened very, very quickly, which is unusual. And the other unusual thing is that, you know, monetary and fiscal policies have been implemented really quickly. Usually it's like they're the last ones to figure out that we're actually in a recession, and they start to, you know, the Fed starts to lower rates and the government starts to do what they can do on the fiscal front to try to rejuvenate the economy. But this one, it became very obvious to everybody. Like I said, you didn't need to be an economist to figure this one out. So they reacted very swiftly with liquidity and some fiscal solutions and maybe more coming. Stay tuned. And, you know, the economic implications necessitated by these health concerns were recognized really by Main Street and Wall Street. Everybody gets this. So it's not as complicated as past recessions, you know, like the 2001 triggered by the dot-com crash or the 08-1 triggered by the big bad banks. You know, and it's interesting because Wall Street strategists and investors are already starting to debate what type of recovery we're going to have, a V-shaped, an L-shaped, a U-shaped, et cetera. And I think what's important to us right now is just that the virus cases peak out and actually start to decline sequentially at some point over the next couple of months, and business activity can at least start to resume. So, you know, and what type of recovery ultimately it is, remember, even after the global financial crisis, we had a substandard economic recovery for over 10 years, and it didn't stop the stock market from going up 15% a year for 10 years. that you were able to get great returns, even, you know, in a subpar type environment coming off of that. So, you know, what are we looking for recovery? What are some of the tells in the market that can tell you that things are getting better? Fixed income spreads stabilizing and tightening. This is starting to happen with the Fed flooding the system with liquidity, which is a good thing. The other thing I always like to see is the Russell 2000 index actually outperforming the S&P 500, even on the way down. That's usually a good sign. And then this isn't what we own, but debt companies, debt-laden companies, they actually start performing better in the marketplace after getting annihilated on the way down, which I mentioned earlier has been happening. And then, you know, the number of coronavirus cases simply peaking out and, you know, people getting some confidence that we have a handle on what's going on here globally. You know, as always, we're thinking about the next 3 to 5 years and what's going to recover at some point in time. We don't know exactly when that's going to happen. I would argue nobody knows exactly when that's going to happen, no matter what they may say. And fortunately for us, because we have a quality investment style, it lends itself to high variable costs, low fixed costs. Most of our companies are debt-free and generate positive cash flow, and they're not immune to a recession. But there's no question in our mind that they're going to survive it and ultimately prosper on the other side of this. And really, that's what we stay focused on, is making sure that we own the right businesses that can, you know, make it across this bridge, no matter how long the bridge is, and ultimately prosper and take market share on the other side of this. So those are some of the thoughts that I have, at least from a macro point of view, and, you know, a few comments on mid-cap growth, which is a portfolio that I co-manage. It's hung in there very well this quarter. Part of the reason is simply that a lot of the sector growth companies that we own in the portfolio are, you know, doing even better in this environment, at least on a relative basis. They're not immune either, but some of the trends that are in place, you know, like that have been in place for a while, like medicine at a distance, you know, things that allow customers to buy things faster, cheaper, and better. Those trends were really in place, and I think that a recession, like all recessions, is really accelerating the trends, whether it's teleconferencing, televideo, telemedicine, shopping at home, et cetera. All these things have been in place, but they've simply been accelerated by the recession that we're clearly in these days. So with that, why don't I just throw it open to John Christensen, who's going to talk to you about small core and some of our other small mid-cap strategies. John?
Yeah, thanks, Doug. Yeah, so just, you know, kind of piggybacking on what Doug was talking about, you know, we run concentrated portfolios across the board in small cap core and others as well. And being in this asset space along with concentration, people imply or think that that's high risk. You know, and our numbers really don't bear that out. And we structure these portfolios in a way so during these types of times exactly, we want to make sure that our companies can hold up well during these difficult times, and each business is picked as such. So when you look at the overall performance across the board, frankly, you know, Doug talked about mid-cap growth, but a lot of our portfolios are holding up very, very well during this very short-term and violent downturn in the market. And it's because of each of those companies that we're buying, each of one of those businesses has lower business risk, lower credit risk, and lower balance sheet risk. And that's really what we're focused on, and it shows up in these types of markets. Now, one of the things that we're focused on too is when we have a downturn like this, there's really an opportunity for us. Yes, we've outperformed on the downside, which is expected, but it's also an opportunity to find a lot of great businesses that we believe were premium priced before, the valuations were too onerous, and now they've come our way. So we've been looking at a lot of names adding to the portfolio that way. And we've also got maybe names in the portfolio that were maybe a lower weight, again, due to valuation. It's a chance for us to fortify the portfolio that way and increase the position as well. So for us, it's really about taking advantage of the outperformance by fortifying the portfolio, because in the end, the market will come back, as Doug said. The question is, we want to make sure that when the market's coming back, that we're able to participate in that. And also, I think what Doug was talking about was also important. I think what you have to identify now is when we're in this type of environment, there's going to be winners and losers long term. And we're just also trying to make sure that we're with the companies that we think longer term in 3 to 5 years will be stronger and more prosperous than they are even today. there may be some industries and sectors that may be permanently impaired due to what we're going through right now. But we want to make sure we're with the ones that longer term will be able to take care of that. And, you know, healthcare, obviously, Doug talked about telemedicine, and there's other areas as well in the in technology and even in consumer that people are going to change a lot of their habits going forward. So we want to make sure we're staying on top of that as well. So for us, it's really about making sure we're doing what we've always been doing, finding great businesses, and now at reasonable valuations, we're finding those even at more numbers now than usual, and making sure that we participate again on the upside. So for us, it's the status quo, doing what we always do best, and that's trying to pick great stocks. So with that, I'll go ahead and hand it over to Craig Crasher.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, John. So, yeah, I think Doug and John hit most of the key points as it relates to international. We manage our international and emerging markets small cap strategies the same way as we do on the domestic side. So, obviously, we're focused on the same things there, you know, companies that have variable cost structures, companies that have strong free cash flow, strong balance sheets, et cetera. I think our laser focus that we emphasize every day of the year, which is we want to own companies that can survive and thrive in any environment. You know, this is the environment where that gets tested and borne out, and you have the benefits of that discipline that we have. So that's no different. I guess the one thing in terms of explaining at least what's happened so far this year, the one difference maybe is that there has been a wide range of outcomes in terms of geographies. Obviously, we're all going through this right now in the U.S. Most parts of Europe are going through the same thing now. Whereas in Japan and places like Japan and South Korea, Taiwan even have weathered the pandemic, at least thus far, with much, much lower economic impact. They haven't gone to the full degree of shutdown that we're seeing in some of the other areas. And so that those stock markets have done relatively well. And it's not just the stock market impact that's been better in those geographies, or worse in the case of, say, Europe, but we're also seeing the impact on the currency. The dollar's appreciated during this crisis, particularly against, say, in terms of major exposures that we have. The British pound is down about 6% year-to-date, whereas the Japanese yen has actually appreciated versus the dollar so far this year. So that's just another angle that you know, has an impact on performance, at least over the short term. And so, that's all I had.
Okay, this is Barry Mandanak. I think what I'll do is ask a couple of questions to get things rolling, and then we'll take questions from the field, if that works. Doug, you mentioned before about how in the past decade, it was a market that many people referred to it as a rising tide lifts all boats market. And that there was a lot of move towards passive investing. But post this whole crisis, there's been a lot more about winners and losers and who's going to survive post-coronavirus and who's not, who's going to benefit and so forth. Do you see that as a protracted focus on a go-forward basis, or do you think we revert back to kind of rising tide lifts all boats?
Well, my guess, and I don't know for certain, Barry, but my guess is if you think back about what happened in the 2008-2009 recovery when it started, the initial phase, like if you remember 2009 to like I think probably 2011 until that crisis hit with the European debt crisis, there's about a two-year period there where it was like risk on, risk off, risk on, risk off, risk on, risk off, and all the stocks went up and down together. And it was really annoying for stock pickers like John, Craig, and me. You know, it's just really a boring time period because there wasn't much differentiation in the early stages of the recovery. And then as time passed, it became more and more apparent that there was more differentiation going on and, you know, companies that were benefiting and companies that were structurally impaired because of what happened in 2008, and the market started to differentiate. So I don't know for certain, but my guess is history will probably repeat itself. When the initial stage of the recovery comes, it will be a rising tide lifts all boats. People will get confidence that, you know, this crisis is past and that earnings are going to recover and companies are going to recover. And so there'll be lots of opportunities. The stuff that you know, is heavily levered will have been smashed and very cheap. And, you know, if it's going to survive, people will buy it and the stock will go from 2 to 5, and that's an enormous return, right? And still at 5, but, you know, that's what happens in the early stage of the recovery. And then as time passes, you know, I don't know if it's 6 months, a year, or 2 years, they'll start getting very selective again, and the rifle shot approach will really matter. We're always stock pickers. We never change what we do. We think that it's important to own the right business, first and foremost, as John and Craig both mentioned. So, you know, that's what we're going to be doing. But it wouldn't surprise me if we had a rising tide environment for a while when this actual real recovery starts.
Another question, you know, when people are starting to rebalance and rebuild equity positions back to long-term strategic allocations, some people may have been thinking about ways to do that, whether it's through large-cap stocks or small-cap stocks or non-U.S. stocks. There is a perception that small companies tend to be a bit more sensitive to economic downturns than their larger peers. What are your thoughts on that concept?
Well, I think in general that's true. I mean, if you'll see when the economy is decelerating or doing poorly, the index, the Russell 2000 index, tends to do very poorly and underperform the S&P 500, just as it's done over the last couple of years as the economy was decelerating, even prior to this advent of the virus. You know, we had a slowdown in manufacturing that's really been going on for about 18 months, almost 2 years, by the time this virus actually hit. So I do think that tends to be the way that the index itself behaves. But our approach, John and Todd Bailey and our small cap group that manages money, we don't, as you know, our active share is almost 99, almost 100%. We really don't behave or act anything like the index. We act more like blue chips, but small cap blue chips. So they can defy and do pretty well even in that kind of environment, as we've demonstrated over the last couple of years and longer term with the strategy. I don't know, John, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, sure, Doug. So, yeah, as Doug said, I mean, when you look at small caps, valuations reflect that, right? And to Doug's point, when we had this downturn, the Russell 2000 went down, it's gone down over 30%. The S&P 500 is down around 19-20%. So obviously it's got hit harder. But remember that markets, when they come back, they're also looking for more growth, and you'll get more growth in general out of the smaller companies. And then when investors run into that, that's how they take the Russell usually up a little bit more than the larger caps because of that. But in the end, you got to remember, when you're buying these companies that are growing, you're also buying their valuations as well, right? So if a company is trading at a really high valuation and it's, let's just say it's growing fast now, well, that valuation, that growth better be sustained. Whereas we'd rather find companies that have maybe a little bit lower growth, but it's more sustained, and buy it at a lower valuation or reasonable valuation and just hold it for a long period of time. And should hopefully, you know, protect us of any downside and still participate in the upside. So I think small caps always are an opportunity. We try to find those companies that are more under the radar, right, not followed by Wall Street, kind of that next generation of blue chips. I mean, if we could find those, that's when people notice them longer term and they have a tendency to do better than anything else in the market.
Okay, I'll ask one more question, and then we're going to open it up to the field. But, you know, you talked earlier about companies and industries, truthfully, that stand to potentially benefit from the post-corona world, if you will. You mentioned healthcare. Many people think of things like Abbott, you know, big companies, or an Amazon in another area that tend to potentially benefit. But are there small-cap companies and industries within the small and mid-cap universes, both domestic as well as international, that stand to play in that space as well?
Sure, this is John. I can take that. Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing you have to remember in small caps, especially when you're talking about, for example, the Russell 2000, just in the healthcare category, the vast majority of the companies in the healthcare sector in the Russell 2000 are biotech companies or very small biotech companies, which are typically companies that we don't invest in because they usually don't have revenue. They don't have, obviously, earnings. So we have a tendency to be a little bit more underweight. What we are looking for in healthcare, in small cap, is some unique plays that maybe have less competition, but are more tied to structural issues in healthcare. So, if, for example, in my mid-cap portfolio, I have AMN Healthcare, which is a staffing company of travel nurses and locum tenens doctors. Even before any of this was going on with coronavirus, our thesis is a structural need for healthcare workers for the next 10, 15 years. We own, for example, U.S. Physical Therapy, a company for small cap growth, which is physical therapy offices. So we try to find companies, again, that have a structural demographic tailwind behind them for many, many years. And so you won't see us buying any of the biotechs, But you will find us investing in names, again, that are adding value and are less reliant on, for example, government reimbursement, et cetera. So for us, it's really about finding those solid businesses under leveraged balance sheets that aren't tied to any sort of reimbursement issues.
Okay, that's great. Operator, we can open it up for questions, please.
And our first question comes line of Brett Rode. Brett, your line is open.
Thank you. Can you guys give me some idea, coming out of this, do your portfolio companies, are they more likely to be companies that may get acquired, or would they be out there maybe acquiring other companies?
John, you want to take that for small cap?
Sure. Yes, this is John. So that's a good question. And actually, ours would be, if you think about the how we invest in our businesses, people say, well, you invest in all these great high-quality businesses. Well, you know, why aren't your companies taken out all the time? We only have maybe one or two companies even acquired per year in a normal environment. And so I would say that the reason they don't get taken out is because think about businesses that typically get bought. They're usually businesses that may be in more financial distress, operational distress, maybe have a one product or a very small niche market that are acquired by other businesses. And that's not typically our types of businesses. Frankly, our management teams don't need to be acquired. They're running great businesses as it is, you know, employing tens of thousands of people, supporting the economy. So I would say our companies in general are less to be acquired. And just on the other side of that, our companies, you know, typically don't make a lot of acquisitions. They make some, but they aren't heavy acquirers. We don't like usually companies that are serial acquirers, because that can tell us that maybe they're growing outside their core competency, maybe they overpay for an acquisition. So we'd rather have our companies grow and prosper just based on their own business and them growing business, taking market share, increasing their client base, and doing so while growing margins and generating great free cash flow that's utilized to pay dividends or buy back shares. So I guess a long-winded answer, but I would say that it's really, typically it's neither.
Thanks. Nice.
And our next question is from line of Michael Corsten. Michael, your line is open.
So with large cap, mega cap companies having such strong balance sheets and the Russell down about 30 to 35% from its peak, do you foresee mergers and acquisition activity picking up over the near term?
This is Doug. I'll comment on that. You know, we're in a funny business. One of the things that's always amazed me, and you saw this in 08, 09, and 2010, even in the early stages of the recovery, there isn't a lot of M&A activity that picks up. There's a little bit that occurs, but not much. There's very few brave buyers in the early stage of recovery because, number one, nobody really knows for certain when that recovery happened. It's great with hindsight always, 10 years later, to look back and market date and arbitrary point in time. But as you're going through it, these boards and boards of directors, you have to get a whole room full of people to agree that now's the time to make a move on another company and make a big corporate bet of some magnitude in terms of capital outlay and money. And rarely do you get everybody around the table to agree unless times are really, really good and have been that way for a while. So I would guess, based on history, that early on you'll see a little brave souls go out there and do some M&A, but it won't be widespread. Volumes will stay low. And until people are very confident that the recovery is in place and has been for quite a while, then you'll get that committee to agree.
To that point, I'm sure I'm not the only one that just saw the news come across that Xerox has dropped it a hostile bid for HP.
And our next question is line of Dave Simon. Dave, your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for all the good work you've done for all of us over the years. My question is a short and easy one. Transports. How quickly do you see those starting to come back? Because obviously it's vital. And I guess the only thing I see is unless the government takes a warrant stake in some of the bigger names, whether it's the cruise line or the airlines, they're going to come back. I'm just curious, do you see it being a very long time for that to occur?
Craig, do you want to take that?
Well, there's a lot of different areas within transports. I mean, I think a lot of the transportation companies that are handling logistics are doing just fine. I think they're still operating, and we've even seen companies like UPS have actually the stocks have been up recently because they're seeing increased activity from people ordering more things online, and they can still deliver because it's just one person dropping from door to door. In terms of the cruise lines, that, as Doug said on some of these topics, when you talk about cruise lines and airlines, that's one that's harder to predict than when this virus is going to end, to me, because I think the cruise line operators and the airline operators are at the whim of the government's decisions of how they decide to handle this and how they're going to treat shareholders. I think the airlines are going to continue to operate one way or another. It's just a question of, whether the equity holders get wiped out in whatever deal the government decides to structure for them. So I think it's largely dependent upon the government, and I'd hate to try to predict any government, much less, not to get political, but this administration tends to be a little bit more unpredictable than most.
Yeah, and I guess I would add on to that, we're not big players anywhere at Kane in those areas like cruise lines and airlines, et cetera, so we're by no means experts. But I agree with Craig. Once you get the government involved or you start taking loans, and just like the banks back in 08, you start opening up yourself to all kinds of political games and goals that don't jive with what shareholders and other people want. So it's a tough game, and the banks, they've lagged the market for 10 years since. So usually the area that gets hit the hardest in a downturn is not leadership on the other side. They're not areas that people are going to gravitate to in a big way other than trading players for a bounce. But unsustainable moves usually don't occur, and for some of the reasons that Craig outlined, I totally agree with that.
Yeah, this is John. I just thought I'd add one more thing. Yeah, I think Craig's point about the logistics is spot on. We own, for example, Old Dominion in our small cap core as well, in our mid cap portfolios, and it's actually up for the year. And they have kind of a hub and spoke model for transportation. So more of those smaller trips and things like that, that can be supply chain is still out there. People are still ordering things online. So that's a company that actually has done pretty well through this whole downturn. But yeah, the cruise ships, I think the cruise ships have more of a balance sheet issue and the debt, and I think they have a revenue issue and demand. I think that, I just don't see people, jumping on a cruise ship as fast as you will a plane, for example. So I think that could be a longer tail in terms of recovery in that particular area.
And our next question is from line of Craig Fahrenbuch. Craig, your line's open.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all you guys are doing, and performance has been great. We own the Virtus Small Cap Fund. Wondering, are there names perhaps that have been on your watch list for years, or companies that you guys have been watching but never, found the opportunity or valuation that you're legging into right now?
The answer is yes. Yeah, unfortunately, we've got some that we're buying right now, and so when we're in the process of buying them, we don't talk about those. But again, you're spot on, because we're a lot of names, as you said, that have been valuation prohibitive until this opportunity, and we've been kind of licking our chops, and finally, these names come our way. It's a chance for us to own these great businesses that we think that disconnect. Right? We love it when there's that disconnect in the market where, as you know. And I think Doug can also verify this. It's like when markets go down, they have a tendency to overshoot on the way down. So that's when we think we have opportunities where sometimes they're pricing these businesses to be going out of business, which is ridiculous. So that's when we can hopefully find that disconnect and that inefficiency and take an opportunity to gather a position and longer term take advantage of it.
Sorry, just to follow up, maybe not specifics, but are there sectors or business models perhaps that you guys are focusing on right now?
Yeah, so the sectors have been varied. We found one in financials. We found one in producer durables. We found one in materials. So it's varied. In the end, we're sector agnostic. We want to just find a great business. And if we find a great business, then it doesn't matter where it is, we'll invest in it. So it's been all over the board.
Thank you very much.
And our next question is the line of Scott Greenbaum. Scott, your line is open.
Yes, gentlemen, thank you for the call and for the performance and your work. John, I had a question about the Small Cap Growth Fund. You folks are talking about opportunities and adding, and I was curious, I think year-end you had about $170 million in cash, and I think you've seen more than that leave the fund. So I'm wondering, are you looking to sell less desirable holdings, or how are you using funds to purchase or fortify other more likable positions, please?
Sure. So, you know, in the end, we don't want to sell just a position or a company just because of a reason for like a value, for something for valuation, but just because of to raise cash. But what we've been doing is, look, our goal is, and this has been the product of our success in a way, in that we've had some companies that market cap wise have gotten very high, and our process is to sell those higher market cap over time, because it's a small cap fund, and
right,
then eventually recycle those and buy a smaller cap name. So our goal really in the end, unless there's a business that we think is deteriorated and it's structurally not sound, then we would sell it. But I'm just saying, a lot of times because these companies have run up, it's an opportunity for us to sell some of those names that are high market caps and use that as a source of cash as well. So that's really that's our goal, really. That's how we've been doing things.
So I assume then after all of this disturbance, that you're becoming more pleased with the look of the portfolio as before, again, assuming long-term returns going forward.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, you know, even some of the market caps obviously have come down as well. But to the more pertinent point, finding new names at lower valuations of great businesses we've been looking at, that's our bread and butter.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
And our next question is from the line of Bruce Bennett. Bruce, your line is open.
Hi. Any thoughts or consideration to reopening closed funds?
This is Doug. You know, we closed Small Cap Core in July of 2018 and Small Growth in September of 2018. And as of right now, you know, we don't plan to reopen either one. We've had very few outflows in Small Cap Core. We've had a little bit more in Small Cap Growth, but it's been completely manageable. So, you know, we'll always reevaluate that from time to time, but as of right now, you know, we don't intend to reopen either strategy for the time being. But, you know, conditions can change in the future, and we can change our mind on that down the road, but that's the way it looks right now to us.
Okay, thank you.
And our next question is from the line of Mark French. Mark, your line is open.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you very much for all that you've done for us and for our clients. Quick question, well, two questions. Firstly, when you evaluate new companies, are you looking, would you say that you look at the financials first, or do you look at the business itself? That's my one question. And my other question is, have you given any thought to, you mentioned earlier that the way that you think about the companies that you look to buy into, you think about the blue chips of the future. Have you ever thought about having a fund that kind of follows the company through the life cycle from small cap to mid cap and then beyond?
John, you want to take the first part of that?
Absolutely. So obviously, when you're looking at a business and you're screening a business, the numbers are kind of the first thing you see. But I don't want to give you the impression anyway that's driving our decision, because the business drives the numbers. That's the bottom line, not the other way around. So yeah, we use screening in a sense of to look for the numbers, but the numbers don't tell the whole story. They don't tell the trend. They don't tell where it's going in 3 to 5 years. So for us, yeah, we look at the business from the numbers, but then our big value add, in my opinion, is digging into the business, digging into the KSQs, proxy statements, understanding the business structurally, understanding the business from the ground up. That's what we're really trying to do. And look, we're also trying to figure out how this business is going to hold up in the next recession, which, you know, kind of we're in now, how this business is going to maintain a competitive moat, right? And why this business in 3 to 5 years is going to be a great business. That's what we're trying to figure out. And, you know, we're not a hedge fund. We're not turning over the portfolio 100% a year. Turning over the portfolio 20, 25% a year. this is an investment decision that will be with us for a long time. We own Jack Henry in small cap core, okay? We've owned that thing over 20 years. Okay? So as long as that company does what it should be doing, this is a long-term investment for us. So that's why for us, understanding the business structurally is really going to be the number one thing I need to worry about. So for us, that's the decision first and always will be. And then just making sure that we're monitoring it ongoing basis and making sure it's doing what we should and making sure that competitive moat is staying wide and deep.
Well, thank you. You've done a great job.
And I guess the second part of your question is we do sort of, not formally but informally, hand off companies, you know, from small cap to mid cap or mid cap even in many strategies to mid cap and even on up to large cap. So we do, as the market cap grows, sometimes we are forced to eliminate them out of their small cap portfolios because the company simply gets too big. And the SMID manager may pick it up or the mid-cap manager may pick it up and so on. We also have an all-cap growth fund, but it's not a mutual fund internally. We have an all, so we can actually take a company from, I call it cradle to grave, in those strategies too. So, but that's not available right now as a mutual fund. So, yeah, we have given that thought, and we do think that's important. And, you know, the idea that a great company suddenly becomes a bad one when it moves from small to mid or large, it's sort of nonsense. It's usually just the opposite. These great, successful companies, you know, properly vetted and properly understood, can be successful investments for a very, very long time.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And our next question is line of Curtis Terry. Curtis, your line is open.
Hey, guys. My question's been answered. Thank you very much. Thanks for the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our next question is line of Sean Hardy. Sean, your line is open.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for doing the call, number one. And two, thanks for all your help over the years with our clients and preservation of capital growth and staying with us through periods like this. Doug, my question's for you. You had commented earlier in the call about, you know, all ships rising again. And what we saw coming out of the financial crisis back in 2009, 2010, and I guess specifically a period from, I would say, 2012 to 2016, was active managers underperforming against passive management. And do you guys see that happening again in that period as you've described it? And if so, what might you do differently?
Well, first of all, I don't think we underperformed during that time period. You know, we get a lot of questions about active versus passive, and I try to stay out of the business of defending every active manager out there because, you know, the fact is there are some active managers that haven't earned their keep over time. And, you know, as an act, and we are clearly active managers, very highly active, and we, like everybody else that's active, have to earn our keep over time and have to prove that we can beat benchmarks on a reasonable time horizon and over a reasonable time frame. And all I can tell you is, you know, we've been in business, you know, in small core since 1992, and we have a long history of being able to demonstrate that we can do that in a variety of environments. You know, and so, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future performance, but we got a pretty good record in being able to do that. And I basically have tried to stay out of the business of defending, you know, active managers overall, especially in the large cap space. I will point out that in small cap, it's, I think there's, the numbers, people take in the active-passive debate from large cap where it's pretty obvious why it favors passive to every asset category out there, and that's not necessarily true. It's not, I don't think Craig could tell you. In international, I don't believe it's true. Emerging markets, it's not true. Small cap, we certainly demonstrated, at least for us, it definitely isn't true. So I don't know. That's, you know, there's periods where we'll underperform. There's periods where we'll market perform because of, you know, whatever the markets happen to be doing at that particular point in time. So nothing in this business works all the time. But, you know, over time, that's all we're trying to do is make sure we're adding value, and we've been able to demonstrate that so far.
Thank you.
And our next question is one of Nicholas Adele. Nicholas, your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for putting together the call here. Really appreciate all of the work you guys have done over the years for us. My question is, if oil stays in the 20s you know, say for the remainder of the year, does that complicate the recovery? And then if so, does it hurt larger companies or smaller companies? Thank you.
John, you want to take that?
Sure. I think it's a great question, actually. That's why I'm kind of laughing, because it's a really very profound, I think, a very good question, because here we are at, you know, as you said, oil in the 20s, and you know, there's two sides of it, right? There's people who say, okay, the consumer will get the benefit of having lower prices and lower input costs for companies. But then the other side of it is, remember, these E&P companies, such as these larger ones, they were doing a lot of heavy capital investments. I mean, billions of dollars of capital investments, and that's jobs. Those are direct jobs that filter through the economy. So I think that's, you know, really going to be telling longer term what happens with those types of businesses. So for us, that's why I think it could be a bit of an impediment, because again, those jobs won't be there. But again, there'll be other parts of the economy, I think, that could make up for that. As we talked about with the remote learning, remote work environment, so other areas of the economy could be accelerating. Telemedicine is going to be accelerating, so healthcare could be growing. So there may be other green shoots that could offset some of that, but there's no denying it's definitely going to be a bit of a headwind, given a lot of that capital investment won't really be there going forward. Doug, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that, you know, in certain states, you know, energy-producing states, you know, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Texas, Permian Basin, obviously there's going to be employment and fiscal constraints and unemployment issues in those particular states, I think. If crude were to do that and stay in the low 20s for an extended period of time, there's going to be, you're already seeing them retrench and cut capital spending. The only good news, I think, about that is that energy has been a disaster basically since the middle of 2014. The meltdown in energy has been actually worse than the dot-com collapse back in 2001. So for many of these companies, like when you go back to 2014, when this initial decline from whatever it was, 110, I think, down to 26 then, you know, there was a lot of industrial companies that sold a lot of equipment to energy companies that were buyers of this, and it was a bigger weighting in the S&P 500, and I don't know, I think energy today is probably like 4% or less of the S&P 500, down from 15 to 20 maybe 10 years ago. So, you know, it's just become a lot less important. If you're in those energy producing states, I think it's still important and will derail the recovery or make it harder or a headwind for those states to recover. But it's not as big as it used to be, because it's just been really a terrible situation for a long time now.
And our next question is from the line of Alex Bizarka. Alex, your line is open.
Hey, guys. How you doing? My question really is about the markets in general. You know, as the global economy continues to be shut down for, you know, indefinitely, for however long, and corona cases continue to spike, and unemployment will continue to spike, and, you know, growth numbers will plummet. In your guys' opinion, how bad do you think this will get? A lot of you, know, our investment partners that we're talking to say, you know, this could easily be, you know, from peak to trough, a 50% drop easily. What's your guys' opinion on that?
Can I assess a 50% drop in what?
Market. In the market.
Oh, in the market?
Yes.
Craig, you want to take that one? You haven't said much today.
I gave you the easy one, huh? Just predict the market. well, we generally try to shy away from predicting what's going to happen to the market in the short term. I mean, I just think that those kinds of things are inherently impossible to predict. I mean, is a 50% downturn possible? I think it would be crazy to say that that's not possible. It's certainly something that is within the realm of, you know, not a 0% chance. It's probably not a near 0% chance. But again, it's just really hard to predict, because none of us know how long this is going to last, and none of us know how hard it's going to hit the various parts of the economy. So I think that that's what you're seeing in the market. That's why there's so much volatility now. is because there's just a really heightened degree of uncertainty because nobody really knows how this is going to play out. So, you know, unfortunately, we can't predict that. Fortunately, if we do the right things in choosing our investments and we own companies that can get through whatever that short-term market volatility is and survive through the economic downturn to get to the other side, you know, I personally think when you look out 2-3 years, people keep talking about how the, you know, whole economy is going to change. I think things are going to be basically back to normal once this happens, and I don't know how long it's going to take, but it appears if you look at the curves in these various countries, you know, they're following somewhat of a similar trajectory over time, and so it does appear that it's going to be a matter of months, not a matter of years before things start getting better. And if you look at China, which is where this whole thing started, you know, with that started in China in January, and it's now March, and China's basically getting back to business. So it's almost back to business as usual in China now, and we're talking about less than 3 months later. I mean, if that's the outcome that happens in the rest of the world, then I don't think we'll be down 50%, but if it keeps going on, you know, longer than that, then all, everything's on the table. But, you know, like I said, we can't really predict that. All we can do is focus on the things that we can control, which is own companies that we know are going to get through this time. And if we do that and we look out several years in the future, you know, this will be hopefully just a blip overall in their earnings for say a year or so, and then and back to business as usual.
I guess the one thing I would add is just that, like Craig's saying, and I hear this from all the managers that work with us at Kane, we have a lot of confidence in the long term that our companies are going to be fine. In the short term, you know, it's anybody's guess, truth be told, right? So so the short term is going to be just that, the short term. But we do have, what we know for a fact is a lot of businesses are down 20, 30, 40% in the last month or two. That's a fact. Everything else is a guesstimate going forward. So, and you know, but we do believe long-term, you know, with the VIX up above 60, I think still we're in the 50s, there's a lot of fear out there right now already. So, and there is a lot of short-term uncertainty for obvious reasons. So, you know, we acknowledge that, but we do have a lot of confidence in what we own over any reasonable time period.
Thank you.
And our next question is from the line of Margaret Beal. Margaret, your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for the call. Thank you for 20 years of great investment performance for our client base. Never been embarrassed to sit before a client to tell them how you've done the last quarter, except for one quarter that I won't remind you. You'll all start running and screaming from the building with your hair on fire about Tempur-Pedic. Won't remind you about that. So somebody answered my question, which I would have said was a plea, like, could you please reopen Smoke Corp, but you've answered that. My other question is this. We have a pretty comprehensive set of clients. We have a number of institutions. They did start rebalancing in January, February, because they got out of balance, you know, although everything was up, equities were up so much. I just wonder, you have far more institutional exposure in your client base. What are you seeing? Are institutions doing anything, or do you expect that they'll be doing anything? Do you have any? I guess, Doug, that's a question for you.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately for us, I think one of the things we do a pretty good job of at Kane is educating our clients in advance of what they should expect in terms of investment performance. And we try to do our best to live up to that. And I think we've been doing that for quite a while and continue to. And so that transparency, I think, really helps in periods like this. And our institutional clients, you know, we get questions, and obviously they're concerned, and, you know, we have meetings with them just like we're having with you all today to try to explain and remind people what we do and how we do it and what the challenges and opportunities are for us going forward. And some of the accounts are rebalancing, and some of the accounts are giving us new money because we have done a good job for them over the years. But I don't think it's a tidal wave of business for us. I think we have seen a lot of foreign money that was going to make its way into the U.S. market. And, you know, with this global shutdown, that's essentially on hold. We'll see what happens to that when the markets, you know, or when business gets back to normal and people can travel again. So we're seeing actually a lot of foreign interest in the U.S. market as well. So So we'll see. But I think, you know, they're definitely not bailing out, you know, if you will. We tend to see more of that short term in some retail accounts, but even there, you know, with all of your help and Bertus's help, well, we haven't seen a lot of that either. So we're encouraged by that.
Well, thank you for that. And, you know, thank you guys for being there. Stay safe. Hope you and your families are safe. Thanks for the call.
Likewise.
Thank you. Same to you.
And at this time, I'm showing that we have no further questions over the phone lines.
Okay. Well, thank you all for joining us on today's call. Doug, I'll ask you one parting question before we wrap it up, and that is, you've been in the business for 3 decades plus, and you have a number of FAs on this call here trying to help clients stay in their seats and really kind of maintain a long-term perspective. Any thoughts coming off this quarter where the S&P is down 20%, what you would be saying to clients?
Well, I think, you know, I remind them that market timing is a really dangerous occupation, and, you know, nobody, if you go back 3 or 4 months ago, nobody was forecasting this kind of decline, and certainly not for this reason. So, you know, I think it's just that, you know, the market, there's volatility in stocks. Remind them of that. That's the way the world works, and recessions come and recessions go. And, you know, the average one lasts about 18 months, and then we're back to the races. And the cause is always different. It's always a different reason that we go into one. But, you know, I think that, you know, you got to believe that, you know, America will get it right at the end of the day, which the country has a long history of doing. Sometimes stumbles its way through that, but, you know, we get through it and come out the other side better and stronger than ever. And I guess the other thing I would do if I was an FA is read, and this comes back to what Craig was talking about China and the recovery that's going on there already, you know, read Nike's latest quarterly report and what's happening with their business in China already. You know, and what you see is, you know, American companies, strong brand name, taking market share, positioning itself for the future, turning this chaos into an opportunity to do really, really well in the future. And I think Nike's not going to be alone in doing that. The great, well-positioned companies, which hopefully we own more than a fair slug of at Kane Anderson Rudnick, will come out the other side of this at some point in time and do extremely well. And turn off your TV set in the interim and stop listening to all the pundits about what's going to happen daily on the market, and stay in your seat and stay committed to whatever investment program that you had in place before, if it makes sense.
Great. All right. Well, thank you. Doug, John, and Craig, thank you all for your time today, and I want to thank all the folks on the call today for calling in during these tumultuous times and listening to the call. Virtus is committed to helping you get through these challenging times, and a replay of this call and others in this series are going to be made available in the Virtus Voices section of our website. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, and we also have an array of client-approved research that you can share with your clients, talking a lot about rebalancing after a decline, the importance of staying the course, really interesting things that are very easy to understand. Please visit our website at virtus.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please don't hesitate to call us at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Stay safe, and thanks again for joining us.